Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Most students of the anti-communist movement during Cold War America recall the cases of Elger Hiss or Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. Few remember the name of Harry Dexter White, the high-ranking Treasury official who was fingered by the same witnesses who accused Elger Hiss, namely Whitaker Chambers and Elizabeth Bentley. At the time, however, White's was a high-profile case. Even Hiss thought White was the real target of the House Un-American Activities Committee, not him. And when White died, only a week after his passionate defense before Congress, much speculation remained about the cause of his death, as well as the truth of the charges made against him. Our guest this week, Bruce Craig, revisits the case of Harry Dexter White in his new book, Treasonable Doubt. Following my conversation with Bruce Craig, Fiona Beattie will fill us in on another of her sites of the week, this one on the International Spy Museum, and John Wiener will provide our guest commentary on the tension between democracy and government secrecy. But first, let's look at some items of historical interest in the news that relate to the subject of this week's interview, the Cold War. For a quarter of a century, Aaron Katz has spent weekdays in a tiny Manhattan office surrounded by yellowed papers and Cold War-era posters. He diligently makes phone call after phone call seeking support for a cause that is fading into history. Katz, 89, is the lone volunteer for the National Committee to Reopen the Rosenberg Case, which aims to clear the names of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were executed on June 13, 1953, in the electric chair in New York's Sing Sing prison for allegedly conspiring to commit espionage. Katz and other aging defenders of the Rosenbergs have never wavered in their belief that the couple was innocent. Even though the Rosenbergs' two sons, who spent much of their lives searching for information to exonerate them, have. Since secret cables were released in the mid-1990s, Michael and Robert Maripol, who took the surname of their adoptive parents, although continuing to believe that the Rosenbergs did not commit the crime for which they were executed, passing U.S. secrets about the atomic bomb to the Soviet Union, have gradually come to accept that it is possible that their father was a Soviet spy during World War II and that their mother knew about it. Katz has not. He still believes they were completely innocent. In the 1960s and 1970s, the National Committee to Reopen the Rosenberg Case included 10 volunteers. Today, Katz works alone. And a 27-year-old Californian has spent his $300,000 inheritance on creating one of the world's leading collection of communist-era East German memorabilia in order to keep that culture from disappearing. Justin Yampol grew up in sunny California, where he nursed an obsession from an early age in the Cold War, in general and in East Germany in particular. He acquired his first artifact when he was 9 years old. Today, at age 27, he owns the largest collection of GDR memorabilia outside Germany, and at the rate he's going, he collects about 50 new objects a week, he may be well on his way to establishing the most extensive range of GDR artifacts in the world. Yampol calls his collection the Reunification Museum, and 6 months ago moved it into new premises, a nondescript former office block in Culver City, an L.A. suburb best known for its glamorous MGM studios. To date, he has spent more than $300,000 of his grandfather's inheritance on his collection. "It all just sort of happened," he explained. "I didn't intend to found a museum. The thing is, nobody else wanted these things. I tried to give them away, even to museums, years ago, but instead of collecting these artifacts, Germans were trying to get rid of them." The East German culture was vanishing, along with its artifacts that were needed for scholarship. "I couldn't let that happen." Now Yampol is envisioning a full-fledged Los Angeles Cold War museum, but that, he admits, is years and about $5 million away. For now, he's content with his small makeshift museum. More on the Cold War in a minute when I speak with Bruce Craig about his new book on accused spy Harry Dexter White. This is Talking History. Whitaker Chambers and Elizabeth Bentley shocked America in 1948 with their allegations that communist spies had penetrated the American government. The resulting perjury trial of Elger Hiss is legendary, but Chambers and Bentley also named Harry Dexter White, a high-ranking Treasury Department official. White defended himself before Congress, but he died only 1 week later, lending much speculation about the cause of his death and the truth of the charges against him. Now armed with a wealth of new information concerning the case, our guest this week, Bruce Craig, has examined this controversial case and explored the ambiguities that have haunted it for more than a half a century. Bruce Craig is Executive Director of the National Coalition for History and the author of Treasonable Doubt, The Harry Dexter White Spy Case. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you, Brian.
Okay, who's Whitaker Chambers?
Well, in order to sort of find out and understand Whitaker Chambers, I think we need to go back into the 1930s very briefly in terms of setting the time frame. The 1930s was a time of tyrants. It was a time of plots, of conspiracies, of assassinations, and of secret agents. It was also a time of mixed loyalties and moral dilemmas. People like Whitaker Chambers, who was an underground courier for the Soviets in the 1930s until his defection in 1938, had a certain amount of this mixed loyalties. And Chambers is perhaps best remembered because of his shocking allegation that spies, people like Alger Hiss, indeed had penetrated the American government.
Okay. Tell us about Elizabeth Bentley. Who was she?
Elizabeth Bentley, like Whitaker Chambers, was a Soviet courier. She was the key contact in a Washington, D.C. spy group that operated during World War II. Her key contact was a man named Nathan Gregory Silvermaster, one of the few Americans in the KGB Hall of Fame who has their picture there. Bentley is particularly important because it was her group of underground spies who collected information about Soviet espionage, about the American government, and was transferred to the Soviets during World War II. We know that many of the documents that these individuals turned over indeed were damaging to the United States, and they've been documented in a group of documents that have recently come forward known as the Venona documents.
Why were so many people in the 30s, and we're talking about really what we would call the best and the brightest of their New Deal generation, interested in communism?
Well, again, we have to sort of bring ourselves back into the 1930s. And if you recall, during the early 30s, we were dealing with the Great Depression. There were inherent weaknesses in the capitalist system. And as a result, many Americans were intrigued by the communist experiment that was going forward in Soviet Russia. The romance of communism did appeal to a certain type of person who indeed envisioned a great day coming, a new world in which workers, ordinary people, would have new powers. The other thing that impacted people in the New Deal generation was the fight against fascism. And for people like Harry Dexter White, like Nathan Gregory Silvermaster, I think it was the fight against fascism that was the key attraction for them.
Okay, good point. Your book is one of, obviously, a library shelves full of books on the anti-communist movement, and maybe it'd be best to position your book by talking a little bit about the historiography. What are the major schools of thought on the anti-communist movement?
Well, there are certainly lots of books on the rise of anti-communism. I find at least a very short, very good one is by a renowned historian, Melvin Loeffler, called The Specter of Communism, The U.S. and the Origins of the Cold War. For people who are interested in reading a left perspective, Joel Colville's book, Red Hunting in the Promised Land, Anti-Communism and the Making of America, is good. And for those who want a more conservative perspective, I think Richard Gid Power's book, Not Without Honor, The History of American Anti-Communism, is a good place to start. Now, each of these books, mine included, actually focus on a number of key issues. How real was the communist threat? The role of the Communist Party USA and its independence or lack of independence from Moscow. The importance of Soviet espionage and the broader communist movement in general, and then those specific questions that biographies like mine address, who was and who was not a spy?
Okay. I want to get to Harry Dexter White, but let's just take a moment because they're so prominent in their cases, Hiss and the Rosenbergs. And
right.
What's the latest historiography on their relative guilt or innocence?
Well, because of the evidence in the Venona decrypts, there seems to be little doubt that Julius Rosenberg indeed was one of the atomic spies. The Alger Hiss case, of course, is a more complex story. Actually, I'm working on a biography of Hiss right now. It's going to be my next book. But I must say that the tide seems to have turned, that most scholars, I think, do agree that the Venona decrypts are highly suggestive that Alger Hiss indeed was a Soviet spy.
Okay, who's Harry Dexter White?
Harry Dexter White was an assistant secretary of treasury under Henry Morgenthau. He is the highest level official ever accused of espionage in the American government. He is remembered prominently for being the co-founder of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. He grew up in Boston. He was educated in Harvard and Stanford and Columbia, a very progressive thinker, an internationalist, a New Dealer. But I certainly found that he was indeed involved in what I would term at least a species of espionage.
Okay, I want to come back to that one because that's a great phrase. But let me ask you first, as we move in that direction, what evidence did Chambers and Bentley have against him?
The evidence that Whitaker Chambers had was a document that came to light during his perjury trial known as the White Memorandum. It's a four-page yellow notepad of information largely relating to Japan. The notes are in Harry Dexter's hand. They are significant. They relate to Japanese policy. So Chambers actually has some physical evidence. Elizabeth Bentley, basically, her testimony is largely uncorroborated. But then we do have some new evidence that came to light in 1996 with the release of the Venona decrypts that shows that Harry Dexter White was, quote, willing to make any self-sacrifice for his beliefs. He feared compromising to the new course if he was discovered. And that memorandum reveals that he was a very, very cautious individual in terms of providing information to the Soviets.
Okay, we've mentioned the Venona papers, as I refer to them, twice already. Mm-hmm. Just give us a sentence or two. What are you referring to?
The Venona decrypts are transmissions between Soviet agents in countries throughout the world and the Soviet head station in Moscow.
Okay, what are the key charges then? Let's get to your phrase, a species of espionage, which is a good one.
Well, there are many, many charges, and this is what Treasonable Doubt does, is address each of them. But largely, the charges of policy subversion were advanced by Elizabeth Bentley. She charged Harry Dexter White with doing all sorts of things, such as precipitating the fall of China in terms of manipulating the price of gold. But to look at her allegations in terms of the evidence that we have, I found at least that the action of Treasury officials in 1944 and 1945 could hardly have precipitated the fall of what was indeed a corrupt and a brutal regime in 1948-1949. All in all, I found that the allegations of policy subversion against Harry Dexter White were totally, totally baseless. But nevertheless, there was a certain amount of truth in terms of the charges that he was involved in what today, at least, we would define as espionage.
Okay. Was he a communist?
No.
And you don't believe he was part of a communist conspiracy, then?
No, he was not a communist. The Venona decrypts established that he was, quote, an influential friend of the Soviet Union. In the lexicon of Soviet intelligence, I would define him as a, quote, trusted individual.
Okay, good. And you don't believe that he leaked classified information vital to national security?
No.
Okay. Now, you write that the saga of Harry Dexter White transcends these basic questions, those I just asked, actually, that his story tells us much about politics and society of the New Deal and early Cold War eras. It's a great sentence. What does it mean?
What it means, basically, is that Treasonable Doubt provides a case study of Cold War espionage. It gives us insight in terms of how the American government operated in a time of crisis. It shows how politicians, even today, look to scapegoats for their own failings. They blame shortcomings in American policy on spies and, to a certain extent, on foreigners. It gives us insight into the internal workings of the FBI, the internal workings of the KGB, and also talk and address the issue of the nature of loyalty in general.
why, I guess this is a question that continually comes up when I discuss this with people, is why years later did congressional committees place so much emphasis, and I'm talking about the post-war period, looking back to the 30s now, on an individual's political past and their interest in communism?
Certainly a person's past reflected their role in and their perceived actions in terms of an international conspiracy. Much like today, with the Bush administration targeting Muslims, for example, as potential terrorists, there is a certain type of a profile. There is memberships of organizations, for example, that can be deemed as being subversive, and this reflects the notion of certain people being a security risk. And certainly what happened with the political past of these people who were discussed before congressional committees and all, thousands of these people were displaced from their jobs in government and in schools and the universities, and also in Hollywood, for example, with the Hollywood writers who were dismissed from their positions.
One last question here, and maybe I might ask you also about your latest project. Before we do that, you're known for having played a major role in declassifying the records of the House Un-American Activities Committee and forcing open the HIS grand jury records. This is a significant contribution, but tell us what that was all about.
Well, the grand jury records for the HIS case are really very important because historically grand jury materials have never been made available to the public. Even today, the grand jury records relating to the Lincoln assassination, the Burr conspiracy, remain closed. I did bring suit, a case known as Craig v. USA, that established the principle that historical significance alone can, under certain circumstances, result in the release of grand jury materials. And that's what I was able to do in the process of writing this book.
Did you do that on a personal level or, let's say, an individual professional level, or is this tied in some way with your work for the National Coalition?
Well, actually, in a way, it was tied in with my work on the National Coalition, but I went to a public citizen litigation group in Washington, explained what my situation was, and had the pro bono assistance of them. All in all, the legal battle that took about 9 years to do resulted in two cases, an appellate case, cost about $490,000. This is an amount of money that many historians don't have access to, myself included. But every once in a while, there is a key case that pro bono law firms are willing to move forward with, and I was very fortunate to be able to have their support and their help in winning the release of those grand jury materials.
Yeah, it was a major victory, too. But we hadn't planned on going in this direction, but in the 2 minutes we have left, tell us what you're going to do with HIS.
Well, what I'm working on the Alger HIS case right now, I'm not all that interested in terms of the HIS case, per se. In fact, that's only going to be like one chapter out of a book that I envision is going to be 13 or 14 chapters. What I'm interested in is looking very critically at the man. What made him do what he did? What made him a key player in the New Deal? What actions and activities did he take as a high-ranking official in the Roosevelt administration? And particularly of interest to me is how did the man deal with his life after the conviction of perjury, after he no longer held the position of high authority? And how did he manage to reconcile his beliefs as a young man with his actions as an older man?
Are there new documents involved in this book as well, or are you just sort of re-examining what has already been made public?
Well, I'm going to re-examine what certainly has been made public and integrate some of the biographies that have come out recently, but I'm also trying to get access to some of the HIS-specific related materials in the Soviet archives, which is a little bit more difficult, but I do think that type of information is going to be made available. Also, I'm trying to get some additional material out of the Venona decrypts that I think will be important in terms of looking at this particular case.
Being an Americanist, I don't know the answer to this, but how do you access the Russian archives?
It's done through contacts.
Okay.
And to a certain extent, it's done through laying out silver coins in people's hands.
Straightforward answer. I like that one. Okay, well, thanks for being with us, and I hope you'll come back when you finish your HIS book.
Thank you, Brian.
Great. You've been listening to Bruce Craig, author of Treasonable Doubt, The Harry Dexter White Spy Case, published by the University Press of Kansas. This is Talking History.
Espionage was a major part of the Cold War, but it began long before the Cold War and continues to this day. Here to tell you about a museum devoted to the fascinating history of espionage is Talking History's Fiona Beatty.
The world of espionage is glamorized on screen and on paper. And if you're curious to discover its history and learn about the challenges faced by real spies, a visit to the International Spy Museum on Washington, D.C.'s F Street is a must. The permanent exhibit highlights what it calls the tradecraft of espionage. The ingenuity and imagination of real-life spies is more daunting than the slick ease of Ian Fleming's James Bond. Key to this revelation is the opportunity for visitors to immerse themselves in the world of espionage by adopting a cover, breaking codes, identifying other spies, and even becoming the object of surveillance themselves. If immersion and interactivity are seminal to the experience, the historical and factual components make up the equation. The exhibit examines actual events using artifacts and first-person accounts. In the briefing room, designed as a real intelligence agency briefing room, visitors watch a film focusing on the daily realities of spying. In another section, Tricks of the Trade, visitors learn how spies are recruited, trained. And interactive exhibits test visitors' skills in observation, threat analysis, audio surveillance, and clandestine photography, among other things. Artifacts in this section include a KGB coat with a buttonhole camera, and most intriguing, a CIA disguise kit. But no exploration of the world of espionage can be complete without a look at its history, before the Cold War. Why, for instance, is George Washington known as the father of American intelligence, or Daniel Defoe the father of the British Secret Service? Of course, women have always played a role in espionage, and this is explored in Sisterhood of Spies. And for those interested in knowing which celebrities have been involved in espionage, the section Spies Among Us will prove fascinating. Who could have known that Julia Childs, revered for her cooking, once processed classified documents for the OSS? War brings with it the necessity to act clandestinely, and the museum has a special exhibit, The Enemy Within, Terror in America, 1776 to today, designed to provide an historical perspective on acts of terror that have taken place in America. The exhibit begins with the War of 1812 and the burning of the White House. A century later, in 1916, massive explosions rocked Manhattan's New York harbor when German secret agents and American collaborators blew up a munitions depot. And the enemy still lurked within when anarchists bombed the home of Attorney General Mitchell Palmer in 1919. And if all of that gives cause for pause, the Spy City restaurant offers the opportunity for reflection and respite. To find out more, go to www.spymuseum.org.
And finally, John Wiener joins us to give us his thoughts on the recent heated debate over the appointment of Alan Weinstein as Archivist of the United States and how that battle relates to the larger quarrel over White House secrecy. Wiener, a contributing editor of The Nation, is the author of Historians in Trouble, Plagiarism, Fraud, and Politics in the Ivory Tower. He teaches history at the University of California, Irvine.
On Inauguration Day last January 20th, the classified papers of former President George H.W. Bush became eligible for release to the public. That's because the law specifies that a president's papers should be released 12 years after he leaves office. Historians and journalists are hoping those papers will shed more light on the first President Bush's decisions not to pursue Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and not to occupy Iraq during the first Gulf War in 1991. Those papers could also resolve questions about Bush Sr.'s pardons in the Iran-Contra arms for hostages scandal of the mid-1980s. Overseeing the release of those papers is the responsibility of the Archivist of the United States, and President George Bush has just appointed a new one, historian Alan Weinstein. He's author of two books on Soviet espionage in the U.S. The Weinstein nomination ran into trouble in the Senate last fall after almost two dozen organizations of historians and archivists expressed concern. Although Republicans controlled the Senate, Weinstein was not confirmed until his second try in February. The fight over Weinstein is part of a larger battle over White House secrecy. Most people know the National Archives only as the place you take the kids to see the Declaration of Independence, but the archivist is responsible for more than preserving the records of the past. It's also his job to make them available to the public. Democracy and government secrecy don't mix well. Democracy requires access to information about government and what it's been doing, but government officials often prefer to work in secrecy. Weinstein personifies many of the problems of secrecy in Washington today. His record on access to documents is bad. He's refused to release his own interviews about Soviet espionage to other scholars. He has refused to share his copies of Soviet espionage documents. That violates the American Historical Association statement on standards. It's almost as if the people at the White House said, "Here's a historian who has stonewalled requests for access to his own documents for 25 years. He's our kind of guy." Secrecy is an issue now because in 2001, President Bush issued a new executive order governing presidential records. Now the president has the right to veto the release of presidential papers ordered by the National Archives, even if officials have ruled the papers no longer need to be classified. Former presidents also have been given the right to veto the release of documents. The family and heirs of former presidents also have veto power. Alan Weinstein told the Senate committee that he would go to court to defend the Bush order on withholding presidential papers. In the fight at the archives between democracy and secrecy, right now, secrecy is winning.
You've been listening to John Wiener, professor of history at the University of California, Irvine, contributing editor of The Nation, and the author of Historians in Trouble, Plagiarism, Fraud, and Politics in the Ivory Tower. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. Hope you've enjoyed the show. As always, we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that our producer is Fiona Beatty, that our studio engineer is Alex Smith, and that the opinions offered by our guests on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And we invite you to send us your comments on this show by email, if you wish, to talkinghistory@umkc, or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.